Thank you for the warm welcome. I'd like to talk about very serious problems that we're facing right here at home. But for a little perspective, I would like to start with some very important events that are taking place right now, far away, in an area of the world where the United States has been intensely involved for a long time and surely will continue to be. Right at this moment, there are massive demonstrations taking place in Egypt, mostly young people, many thousands of people in the streets facing police brutality, protesting the terror and venality of the dictatorship which the U.S. Strongly supports. This is the first of the anticipated spillovers from what's been going on in Tunisia in the past days. Very impressive democratic movement in a police, I'm quoting, in a police state with little freedom of expression or association and serious human rights problems, ruled by a dictator whose family is hated by the population for the corruption and the brutality of the family regime. Well, as perhaps you know, I'm quoting the U.S. ambassador in a secret cable that was released by WikiLeaks. Shortly after the cable arrived in Washington, the government provided substantial military aid to the Tunisian dictatorship that the ambassador had described. Tunisia was one of five foreign beneficiaries of that grant of aid, Israel routinely, and two other Middle Eastern dictatorships, along with Tunisia, Egypt, and Jordan, and the fifth was Colombia, the country that has long held the prize for the worst human rights record in the hemisphere and has been the leading recipient of U.S. military aid throughout this whole period in the hemisphere, a correlation that generalizes, unfortunately. Well, there's a guiding principle in this and many other cases. It was articulated clearly a couple of days ago by Marwan Muasher. He's a Carnegie Endowment Middle East specialist, former high official of the Jordanian government. He's reacting to what was happening in Tunisia. He says, the traditional argument put forward in and out of the Arab world is that there's nothing wrong, everything is under control. He's quite correct, and the argument generalizes far beyond the Arab world. It generalizes to the domestic scene in the United States as well. Right now, in fact, if the population is sufficiently passive and obedient, everything's fine. Doesn't matter what else is happening. The guiding principle is that the powerful should try to gain their ends by any feasible means, supporting harsh dictatorships in the current Middle East case. And that's fine. One can ignore the popular will as long as the population's kept under control. And the pattern's quite general and very significant for us in a number of ways. One I've mentioned, namely the guiding principle, applies right here to us. So obviously significant for us. It has indeed throughout American history. I'll return to that. Another reason is that this guiding principle, this contempt for the population as long as they're under control and reliance on dictatorships, is a very direct and serious security threat to us. It's a root cause of the terror that Washington is theoretically seeking to combat, but in reality is consistently stimulating by pursuing this guiding principle. Incidentally, that's also at the root of the huge military budget of the U.S., about the same as the rest of the world combined, strangling the economy. Half of the famous deficit, the other half of the famous deficit, which Mr. Obama will be talking about in the State of the Union message, and I'm sure won't mention, the other half of the deficit is the totally dysfunctional privatized healthcare system, about twice the per capita costs of any other of comparable countries, some of the worst outcomes. If we had a health system of the kind that comparable countries have, there would be no deficit, and probably there would indeed be a surplus. Well, going back to the root cause of terror, you'll recall, I'm sure, after 9/11, President Bush declared that they committed the terrorist crimes because they hate our freedoms. Shortly after that, a major Pentagon study group, the Defense Science Board, reacted to President Bush's comment in a report, like others who know anything about the history and the current circumstances of the region. They concluded, I'm quoting them, that Muslims do not hate our freedom, quoting Bush, but rather they hate our policies. When American public diplomacy talks about bringing democracy to Islamic societies, this is seen as no more than self-serving hypocrisy. These views, incidentally, are quite conventional, among specialists at least, who also understand that these U.S. policies are a gift to the extremist among the jihadis. General consensus on this is formulated clearly by David Gardner. He's Middle East correspondent of the world's leading business daily, the Financial Times, many years of experience in the region, books and so on. He says, so long as the jihadis can rely on the United States to stand by its Arab allies, such as the House of Saud and President Mubarak of Egypt, then the bin Laden franchise's monstrous bet that it can foment a class of civilizations may be evil, but is not wholly mad. If we continue to connive in the survival of tyranny, we abet the onward march of the jihadis, for whom Western policy is their most consistently reliable ally. That same observation was made by Michael Scheuer, who for many years was in charge of tracking bin Laden for the CIA. He concludes that the United States of America remains bin Laden's only indispensable ally, and that remains true. Obama is a very strong supporter of the House of Saud and the Egyptian dictator, who's now under siege in Cairo and Alexandria. The insights are by no means new. This is all old hat. In 1958, President Eisenhower, in internal discussion since declassified, consulted with his staff on what he called the campaign of hatred against us in the Arab world, and not among the governments, who are mostly supportive, but among the people. And it was pretty striking in 1958, because just shortly before, Eisenhower had intervened to force Israel, France, and England out of the Sinai, which they had conquered, an act of aggression. But instead of gratitude, there was a campaign of hatred. About the same time, the National Security Council, top planning body, released a report in which they explained the campaign of hatred. They said, the report says, that there's a perception in the Arab world that the United States supports harsh and brutal dictatorships and blocks democracy and development because we want to make sure we control their energy resources. And it went on to say that the perception is pretty accurate, and furthermore, that's what we should be doing, following the guiding principle that as long as the population's controlled by the dictators, everything's fine. Right after 9/11, the Wall Street Journal, to its credit, did a poll among wealthy Muslims, the kind of people it cares about, people, you know, directors of multinational corporations, wealthy professionals, people deeply embedded in the U.S.-run system in the region. And they wanted to know what they thought about the 9/11 attack. Reactions were pretty much what the National Security Council described in 1958. They said that there's anger in the region about U.S. support for dictators, for U.S. Blocking democracy and development. And by 2001, there were more specific complaints. One of them was about the murderous sanctions on Iraq, which murdered literally hundreds of thousands of people, strengthened Saddam Hussein, and forced the population to rely on him for survival, probably saved him from the fate of other dictators we support. That didn't get much of a ripple here, but in the region, people notice when hundreds of thousands of people are slaughtered by a brutal and harsh sanctioned regime, U.S., of course. And the other thing by then, not in 1958, was U.S. support for Israeli occupation and terror and violence. Well, that's after 9/11 among wealthy Arabs. You can imagine what the reaction would have been if they'd done a broader poll. The same was true of the Iraq War. The Iraq War, you should remember, was undertaken with the expectation that it was going to increase terror. That's the expectation from intelligence agencies, including the CIA. More material has come out recently from the Chilcot hearings in England. England's actually carrying out an investigation of the build-up to the war, which we're not. And the counterpart to the CIA released information that the British government was aware and the CIA was aware that the attack was likely to increase terror. French intelligence, others said the same thing, as did many specialists, and it happened. In fact, more than was expected. Terror the year after the invasion of Iraq went up by a factor of 7 using U.S. government statistics. That's quite a sharp rise, even more than was anticipated. Actually, there's a dramatic illustration of that that's taking place right now. Of the doctrine that, the Muashar doctrine, that as long as the population's under control, everything that's fine. I'm sure you've been reading about WikiLeaks, the big, exciting revelation, the one that got all the headlines, was that the Arabs support our policy towards Iran. Well, maybe true or not, but notice what they were referring to. They were referring to the Arab dictators. The Arab dictators, they claim, support our policy. And that's the way the press covered it, and that's the way commentary was. A lot of self-adulation about the fact that we're supported by the Arabs. Well, as it happens, just a couple of weeks before that, the Brookings Institute, major institution in Washington, had released a poll taken by a leading U.S. polling agency, which has been conducting polls in the Arab world for many years, and it showed that it was a poll of the population, not the dictators, and it showed that indeed there were some of them did fear Iran at 10%. In contrast, 77% regarded the U.S. as the major threat to the region, and 88% regarded Israel as the major threat. In fact, antagonism to U.S. policy was so extreme that a majority, 57%, thought the region would be better off if Iran had nuclear weapons. Well, those polls I don't think were even reported in the United States. They certainly were not mentioned in all of the excited reporting about how the Arabs support our attitude toward Iran. And it's the guiding principle again. As long as the dictators support us, or we think they do, and as long as not much is happening, everything is fine. It's quite striking that this was accepted, kind of expected, in the diplomatic service and the State Department, but it was also in media reporting and public commentary, pretty much across the spectrum, liberal commentators too, as far as I could tell. And again, the polls I don't think were even reported. Perhaps the most serious case of all of these is Pakistan. It's no big secret that the population in Pakistan is now stridently and radically anti-American, huge percentage, it's been increasing over the years. The WikiLeaks cables have interesting material about that. They reveal that the Ambassador Patterson, has been regularly informing Washington that by expanding the Afghan war into Pakistan, as we've been doing, and by pressing the Pakistani army to attack the tribal areas, and by drone attacks and so on, all of this is inflaming public opinion even further. It's also strengthening the radical Islamists, who are now a very serious threat to the country. It's even raising the threat that Pakistan's nuclear weapons, huge supply of nuclear weapons, which incidentally were built with the help of the Reagan administration, it's raising the fear that these might fall into the hands of radical Islamists. I mean, that's the ultimate nightmare, but we must continue. We can continue on the present course, keeping to the guiding principles and facing the consequences, fomenting terror, crashing our own economy, inspiring hatred among oppressed populations that sooner or later are likely to explode, as is happening right now before our eyes, and with consequences that could be very severe, quite severe in Egypt, but in Pakistan, extremely severe, and elsewhere too. But if we decide to pursue this course, we should at least do it with eyes open. Well, let me turn to the domestic scene. Throughout American history, there has been a constant struggle over who should control and who should obey. The founding fathers were quite ambivalent about democracy, even democracy for the narrow sector of people who they felt should participate, namely free men, no women, no slaves. It's worth remembering that the first revolution in the hemisphere that brought about a society of free men, not women, but free men, was in 1804 in Haiti. One of the reasons why Haiti was so feared and repressed by the United States, which was terrified that this might spread, same with Europe, and still is up to the present moment. But not here. Here it was supposedly democracy for free men and a limited democracy. James Madison, who was the main framer of the Constitution, as you know, he was concerned that if voters could determine policy, then the majority would challenge privilege, and they would insist on policies in the interests of the large majority of the population. And that's unacceptable. So he therefore framed the constitutional order so that power should be in the hands of the Senate. That's the way it was set up under the Constitution. The executive was an administrator. Power was in the hands of the Senate. The Senate, according to Madison, as he explained in the debates of the Constitutional Convention, he said the Senate represents the wealth of the nation, the more capable set of men who have respect for property owners and their rights and understand that the primary task of the government, I'm quoting him, is to protect the minority of the opulent against the majority. Well, in order to ensure this outcome, the Senate was given the most power, and senators were given six-year terms, and they were elected by legislatures, so they'd be under control. Remember, it wasn't until a century later, under the 17th Amendment, more than a century, that under very substantial popular pressure, direct election of senators was established. That's what the 17th Amendment is. And now, quite interestingly, the far-right supporters of unhindered corporate power are talking about rescinding the 17th Amendment. So put power back where it belongs, in the hands of property and their rights, people who know how to protect the minority of the opulent against the majority. Madison, to his credit, very quickly perceived that the system that he had established was seriously undermining his own principles of justice and freedom. Just a couple of years later, in 1792, he lamented, I'm quoting him, about the daring depravity of the times as the stock jobbers, that's our Wall Street, are becoming the tools and tyrant of government, bribed by its largesses and overawing it by clamors and combinations. He could be describing what's happening right now. The words apply quite precisely. A little less literary flair, but exactly right. The struggle for popular democracy continued after the Constitution. It's always been, particularly in through the century, 19th century and on, it's always been the labor movement which was at the forefront. It's been a core element. We might remember that, or discover if we don't know it already, that in the mid-19th century, American workers regarded wage labor as essentially the same as chattel slavery, differing only in that it was temporary. That was the banner under which Northern workers fought the Civil War, eliminate all slavery, chattel slavery and wage labor. In fact, that was such a popular idea that it was the slogan of the Republican Party and Abraham Lincoln. There was at the time a very lively free press. Actually, that's the period of the most exuberant and lively free press in American history. It included a labor press, which was written and produced by workers in factories, many of them women from the farms who were called factory girls. They condemned what they called the new spirit of the age. This is 1850. The new spirit of the age, gain wealth, forgetting all but self. Sound familiar? And the reduction of working people to, I'm quoting it now, to a state of servitude under the domination of a moneyed aristocracy hanging over us like a mighty avalanche, threatening annihilation to every man who dares to question their right to enslave and oppress the poor and unfortunate, the owners and managers. The labor press also condemned what it called the bought priesthood of the media, the universities, the intellectual class, apologists for power, who sought to justify the despotism that was strengthening its grip the demeaning values that it upheld. They also held, quoting again, that those who work in the mills should own them. Now, these are ideas that became the rallying cry of the organized labor movement in the late 19th century, including its more conservative elements, and have a lot of significance for today. Right now, the government corporate alliance, as you're aware, is closing plants that could be converted to production of things that the country badly needs, like, for example, high-speed rail or green technology. But for that to happen, it would be necessary to recover the democratic spirit of working people of the 19th century, which was renewed in the 1930s with very significant effects, battered by bitter class war since then. Well, it actually, if you look back over the history, it was no small task to drive these ideas out of people's heads, probably not very far below the surface, and also to beat down the democratizing forces of the labor movement. The United States, for all kind of historical reasons, happens to have an unusually class-conscious business class, and not by accident, we also happen to have a very violent labor history. Hundreds of American workers were being killed by security forces and labor actions well into the late 1930s, and nothing similar had been taking place in Europe throughout the century. In Europe, also, unions were far more solidly established, along with parliamentary labor parties. That disparity is, once again, quite great, much to the detriment of American society, in my opinion. Well, despite the reliance on violence, by the time of the First World War, the business classes were coming to realize that so much freedom had been won by popular struggle that it was becoming impossible to control the public by force. They recognized around the First World War that new means had to be devised in order to control the public, to maintain that guiding principle. And the new means that they devised were control of opinion and attitudes and diversion of the population away from the political arena. This is all very self-conscious, incidentally. Read all about it in the business press. That's when the public relations industry, now a huge industry, that's when it began to develop in the two freest societies in the world, Britain and the United States, where the problem was greatest. The goals were very explicit. Read some of them. The goals were to engineer consent of the masses so that the intelligent minority could rule without disturbance by ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, that is, the population. Their role is to be spectators, not participants in action. These outsiders must be fed necessary illusions and emotionally potent oversimplifications in order to keep them under control. Actually, I'm not quoting from the right. These are leading progressive intellectuals, Wilson, Roosevelt, Kennedy, liberals, Edward Bernays, who was one of the founders of the public relations industry, Walter Lippmann, who was the most prominent public intellectual of the 20th century, the distinguished moralist Reinhold Niebuhr, who's called the theologian of the liberal establishment, incidentally Obama's favorite philosopher, he's told us. If you move over, a lead opinion was similar across the spectrum, and it gets naturally much harsher as you move to the right. And the similarity to the debates in the Constitutional Convention is quite evident. Also the similarity to the Muashar doctrine that the U.S. is applying in the dictatorships that it supports. Well, the business press, back around the same time, urged that people should be directed to what it called the more superficial things of life, like fashionable consumption. That'll keep them away from trying to participate in decision making through the political process, let alone in their working lives as 19th century workers demanded. By now, marketing is about one-sixth of the economy, and much of marketing is just pure propaganda. Same thing's happening to elections. Increasingly, especially in the last 30 years, their PR extravaganzas. That's particularly since the 1970s when major changes took place in the economy. I'll come back to that. We're now in a situation where both markets and democracy are being very effectively undermined by the business classes and others who praise them to the skies. If you've ever taken an economics course, you've learned that markets are based on rational, on informed consumers making rational choices. And you're supposed to repeat that when you take an exam. If you've ever looked at television and looked at an ad, you know that business is pouring huge efforts into creating uninformed consumers who will make irrational choices. They want to undermine markets in their own interest. So, for example, if we had a market system and, say, General Motors was advertising a car, they'd put up a small ad saying, here are the characteristics of the cars that we're going to sell next year or try to sell. Well, you know, they don't do that. What they do is have a famous football player, or a Hollywood actress, or somebody, car performing some miraculous thing, you know, and the effort is to try to delude you, to try to create uninformed consumers who will make irrational choices, thus undermining markets. And democracies undermine the same way. Not surprisingly, it's the same people. PR agencies who put up the ads are also running the elections. So in elections, you don't provide information about the candidates. It's the last thing you want to do. What you do is try to delude people with rhetorical devices, with slogans, and so on and so forth. But keep the issues out of sight. Good reasons for that. Come back to it. Well, this has been going on since the 19... I mean, it goes on way back, but there was an upsurge in the 1970s. You all know what happened in the 60s. And there was a huge corporate backlash against the popular uprisings of the 60s, which were really civilizing the society and making it more democratic and free. That's unacceptable. There was also a lot of legislation in the public interest and against the interests of business, like the Environmental Protection Agency, or OSHA, defending safety standards, health and safety standards for working people, the Earned Income Tax Credit, probably the most important liberal measure since the New Deal. There was the Consumer Product Safety Commission. There's a very sharp expansion of Social Security and other social measures. All of this, incidentally, was under Nixon. Nixon was the last liberal president. After that, it's all back to the Stone Age. And business was appalled by this. That right at that time, there was a vast increase in lobbyists to shape and control legislation, actually to write it, to serve corporate interests. There was the beginnings of the major attack on regulation, which is an interference with corporate prerogatives. It also protects the economy and people, but doesn't matter. All of this was expanded substantially under Reagan, and even more so under his successors, Clinton and Bush. Most of it under Clinton, in fact. There were new think tanks were established, like the Heritage Foundation, to try to take over the ideological spectrum. The cost of campaigns skyrocketed at that time. That compelled the parties to become supportive of business. For the Republicans, it's kind of second nature. The Democrats had a somewhat different constituency, not much, but they were compelled to go along to survive, and they did. So you get this sharp rightward move of both parties. Clinton wasn't joking when he said that now we're all Eisenhower Republicans. That's correct. The Democrats are now what used to be called moderate Republicans, like Eisenhower, and the Republicans are so deep in the pockets of business you need a telescope to find them. Well, that's campaign spending, incidentally, is a very good predictor of electoral victory. And more significant than that, and less obvious, is that it's a very good predictor of the policies that are pursued. There's really outstanding work on this by a number of political scientists, primarily Thomas Ferguson, who's the main person who studied it, his book, Golden Rule, and others. Well, to understand, to put that into place, what was going on in the 70s and since, it's useful to take a quick look at the post-World War II period. Now, the 50s and the 60s, which were still under the influence of the New Deal and a powerful labor movement, they were the greatest growth period in American history. And furthermore, it was egalitarian growth. So the lowest quintile, lowest 20%, did about as well as the upper quintile. You know, of course, they got more, but proportionately. This is often called by economists the golden age of American capitalism, more accurately, American state capitalism. In the 1970s, there were major changes. One was a fundamental shift of the economy away from production towards financialization. The role of financial institutions, they have a role, you know, to direct unused assets to productive uses, and that's more or less what they were doing in the 50s and the 60s. Now they do almost none of that, and they're probably harmful to the economy. But they also grew enormously. There were a few percentage of corporate profits back in the 60s. It's now maybe a third, probably hit 40% at the peak right before the recession. And along with this was the hollowing out of production. It's essentially not that production stops, it's just shipped abroad. Has a lot of advantages. It sets working people in competition with one another all over the world, and that has the obvious effect of lowering wages and benefits. That's fine for corporate profits and for banks and investment firms. It's terrible for the workforce and the middle class, but now we're back to the guiding principle. As long as they are quiet and passive, everything's fine. Meanwhile, state corporate policy, government policy specifically, has been increasingly geared to welfare for extreme wealth and privilege. The extent of this is pretty shocking when you look at the details. And we all know that, or should know, that inequality has maybe reached the highest level in American history. But that's misleading, because the sharp rise in inequality has to do with the extreme top of the income spectrum, the top 1%, even the top 0.1%. Now, that's where there's been a spectacular increase in wealth. That's predominantly corporate executives, hedge fund managers, and so on. Tax cuts have been very carefully crafted to benefit the super rich, particularly this tiny slice of super rich. That's very careful, so very carefully done. So take, say, the Bush tax cuts. It's now a huge burden on the economy, big part of the deficit. But remember, they were established in 2001, and they were supposed to last for 10 years. The assumption is once you establish a tax, it's never going to be, tax cuts never going to be raised, because it'll be politically difficult. When they were crafted in such a way that people wouldn't see what was happening. So for the first couple of years, it wasn't egalitarian, but it wasn't hugely in favor of the super rich. So people had a sense, okay, we're all getting a tax cut. In fact, one of the first things that happened was, it was carefully designed, everybody got a small tax rebate, so you felt good, look, we're having a tax cut. Meanwhile, if you look over the 10-year period, what was designed was that as you go through it, it'll be geared more and more to the super rich. And by the end of it, 2010, literally over 50% of the tax cut was going to the top 1%. But that's not so visible. So, and it was hidden in all kind of other ways, you know, stock options and so on. But that's very careful design, very clever, even has a name. It's called the sunset technique. You pretend that you're giving a tax cut to everyone, but by the time the sun sets, it's going to the right people, you know, the top 1%. Actually, that's happening right now before our eyes. The lame duck Congress is greatly praised, you know, Obama's praised for his wonderful achievements in the lame duck Congress. There was one major achievement, namely a tax break for the wealthy, which of course greatly increases the deficit, and a rather remarkable PR operation was carried out. In fact, pretty impressive. The tax cut for the wealthy was opposed by about two-thirds of the population. The deficit, we're told every day, mostly falsely, is a huge problem. But here we are with the Republicans straight out, and Obama going along, increasing the deficit, carrying out a tax cut for the rich, which was the issue, over the objections of the great majority of the population. Well, kind of an experiment, see if people keep quiet even when this is happening before their eyes. Actually, it was more than that. Right at the same time, with everybody screaming about how awful taxes are, there was a tax increase, substantial tax increase for federal workers. It was disguised. It was called a freeze. But if you think for a minute, a freeze for people in the public sector is identical to a tax increase for people in the public sector. The State of the Union address, Obama's apparently going to announce a five-year freeze. Well, that means a five-year tax increase for federal workers, and also a reduction, a freeze, remember, is a reduction because of inflation, population growth, and so on. So he's going to announce a reduction in services for working people and the middle class, and the rich don't care, they don't use the services. And that's going to be presented as a great achievement, you know, addressing the deficit. And actually, we should have a deficit during a recession, but that's a separate question. And I mentioned before what the deficit is really due to. Half of it military spending, not for defense, a fact that harms security, and the other half the totally dysfunctional healthcare system. It's all makes sense if you have the right principles. Tax increase, so-called freeze for federal workers, relies on another very effective PR campaign that's been going on for a couple of months now, namely demonizing working people in the public sector. That's been successful, as polls show. Now, people are beginning to accept the message that our financial crisis is not due to huge bonuses and Goldman Sachs, but to the fact that teachers and police and firefighters are getting overpaid and have these wonderful pensions and so on. I mean, all total lies, but lying is so routine by now that it's not even worth mentioning. It's just the mode of discourse. And the same is going to be true of the, presumably, of what is going to be announced in the State of the Union. There was also, during the lame duck session, an interesting device introduced, a payroll tax decrease for Social Security. Now that sounds good, and people feel good. They're going to get a little money in the mail. But just think about it for a minute. It's a Trojan horse. the Social Security tax decrease was carefully timed for 2 years. That means it's going to come up during the next election. Okay, that's the sunset technique again. Then everybody knows that during an election, nobody's going to call for an increase in the payroll tax. So therefore, it'll become permanent. And if it becomes permanent, that is a great consequence. It helps defund Social Security. Social Security is actually in very good shape, and despite what you read in the press, it contributes zero to the deficit. And furthermore, it's well-funded for a long time to come. But if you defund it, then it'll be in trouble. And there's a standard technique of privatization used all the time. It's being used right now in public education. Maggie Thatcher used it in England when she wanted to privatize the railroads. Defund something, and then it stops working, and then you have a clamor about making it work, so you have to privatize it. Absolutely standard and routine. I mean, it takes genius not to see it. So the idea is defund Social Security, then it'll be in trouble, and then we'll have to privatize it. That's a huge bonanza for Wall Street. Trillions of dollars of capital are going to go into the hands of financial managers play games with, make huge profits, and when they get in trouble, as they will, get bailed out. Of course, it also substantially increases insecurity, but that doesn't affect the wealthy, certainly not the super rich. Peter Peterson, billionaire, who's been heading the campaign to destroy Social Security for years, and one of his standard lines is, I don't rely on Social Security. And that's true if you're a billionaire. But for most people, it's the means of survival, especially now that their wealth has collapsed after the fake wealth of the housing bubble burst. Apart from the fact that Social Security helps the middle class and the working people and not the wealthy, there's another reason for trying to get rid of it. It's based on a very dangerous principle, Social Security. It's based on a principle of solidarity and sympathy. Social Security is based on the principle that you care if a disabled widow across town is starving. And you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to gain wealth, forgetting all but self. You know, the new spirit of the age, 150 years ago, and not care about other people. And that's drilled into people's heads from childhood. And Social Security stands as in opposition to that. And so do public schools. The public schools are based on the principle that even if you don't have children in the school, you care whether the kids go to school. So therefore, there should be a good education for them. And that, again, is no good. Public schools don't mean a thing to wealthy people, but they do mean a lot to the population. And that spirit of solidarity and sympathy, that's quite dangerous. That could spread and lead to other consequences. These are major developments right now. They're all part of a systematic campaign of a quite bitter class war, which has many aspects. In fact, it's happening in many ways which aren't visible. Actually, the tax cuts for the rich are also not very visible. One of the ways that it's being carried out is by changing the rules of corporate governance. Now, those are established by the government. Corporations are state-created artificial entities, and the government sets the rules of corporate governance. They've been changed substantially in the United States, not in other countries. So, for example, chief executives are now permitted, under the new rules, to select the boards that determine their salaries. Okay. Doesn't take a genius to figure out what's going to happen from that. There's techniques have been devised by the government to allow executives to get stock options instead of direct pay. That's a way of concealing the huge giveaway to the super rich. There were efforts in the early 90s by government agencies to try to at least get some transparency into that, but Congress beat them down. Deregulation has been going on since the late 70s, and that gives enormous benefits to corporate management. It's very harmful to the population. In fact, we can see that. During the period when the New Deal regulations were in force, there weren't any financial crises, 50s and 60s. Since deregulation began, there's been a series of regular financial crises, right through the Reagan years, on in the Clinton year, big tech bubble, and on, of course, right now is the worst of them. They keep getting worse. Each one's worse. There are direct consequences of eliminating the kind of regulation that would keep a financial system functioning. But it doesn't really matter if they get worse and worse, because the rich make out fine. They get bailed out each time. So the trick is the public pays the costs and the rich make the benefits. It's a wonderful system. One part of this, everyone knows about the bailouts. They're visible and they create a lot of anger, but they're the least of it. Much more significant was that than that was the Treasury and the Fed giving very cheap credit, making cheap credit available to collapsing the corporations and banks, and plenty of other devices. They far outweigh the TARP subsidy. There's also a crucial government insurance policy. The government insures big corporations and banks against failure. There's a name for that. It's called too big to fail. That means if you're a big bank, or you're Goldman Sachs or Citigroup or something like that, you know you're not going to fail, because if you do, the taxpayer's going to come in and bail you out. Well, that creates very perverse incentives. It means you should, in fact, take major risks and make a lot of money, and when they collapse, as risky transactions do, don't worry about it. Taxpayer will come in and fill your pockets. Exactly what's happening. Now bigger than ever, just take a look at the bonuses. These developments are sometimes called just inexorable processes, the result of globalization, new technology, and so on. And that can't be true. Europe lives in the same economy that the United States does, but government policies there are completely different in all the respects I mentioned. Take a look at the European countries. Taxes have the traditional role. They reduce inequality. Maybe not by much, but at least they target inequality. It used to be that way here too. Now it's the opposite. The tax system increases inequality and is carefully designed to do so, and it's inequality at the very extreme end. CEOs, bank managers, and so on. That's pretty dramatic. These guys also happen to be the main funders of elections. Well, as I mentioned, the elections have become PR extravaganzas, and campaign managers are not shy about it. They say quite openly that the campaigns must feature, they have to focus on personalities, on rhetoric, and not on issues. And polls show that recent elections, the public is unaware of the stand of the parties on issues. Now, that's not because they're ignorant or unconcerned. It's because a very careful effort is made to keep the issues out of the picture. You're supposed to get the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders out of politics, after all. And there's a particular reason for that, is that there's a tremendous disconnect between policies and public opinion. So that's another reason for keeping issues and policies out of the public eye. Now, actually, it's more nuanced than that. Now, there have been some careful studies of Senate votes. And Senate votes, it turns out, are responsive to a part of the public, namely the very rich. So the top third, if you take a look at the top third of the income distribution. Senatorial votes kind of correlate reasonably well with opinion, overwhelmingly with the very top. You take the middle third, there's no correlation. You take the bottom third, there is a correlation, but it's negative. That means votes are counter to the wishes of the constituency. Well, again, you know, makes sense within class war. Campaign spending is now so extravagant that elections are basically bought by private concentrations of capital. As you may know, Obama in 2008, after the election, won a prize from the advertising industry for the best marketing campaign of 2008, beat out Apple Computer. If you look at the business press, which again is not shy, executives were just euphoric. They said, we've been selling candidates like toothpaste ever since Reagan. This is the greatest achievement we've ever had. It's going to change the atmosphere in corporate boardrooms, you know, new styles and so on. And that makes good sense. I mentioned that the Republicans have just given up being a traditional political party. I mean, simply deep in the pockets of the very rich in the business sector. There aren't the moderate Republicans of the past are now the Democrats, and they're not far behind. So take, say, Obama again. The main source of his funding in the 2008 election, the concentrated funding, was financial institutions, very powerful in the economy now, and they preferred him to McCain, and that sort of carried him over, if you look closely. And they expected to be rewarded. It's the way politics works, and they were. As soon as Obama picked a financial team, economic team, to deal with the financial crisis that the financial institutions had created, he picked their people right across the board, all the Robert Rubin group, straight out of Citigroup, Larry Summers, the high priest of deregulation, Timothy Geithner of the New York Stock Exchange, who had been kind of supervising the shenanigans of the housing bubble and the rest, right along the line. Now, there was actually one exception, Paul Volcker. Paul Volcker was Treasury Secretary under Reagan, but the spectrum has shifted so far to the right so that he's now the liberal in the government. He was the one person there who was calling seriously for financial regulation. And I stress was, because he's just been kicked out. Just a couple of days ago, Volcker was replaced by Jeffrey Immelt, the head of General Electric. Obama was praised for that. Shows he's moving toward the center, meaning the far right, and becoming more business-friendly, even more than before. What was the reason for, it was a good reason for getting rid of Volcker. Financial institutions didn't like him. He was calling for regulation, limited, but some. But why pick him out? Well, actually, that's discussed in the business press, the world's leading business daily, the London Financial Times, points out that Mr. Immelt's appointment was applauded by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, you know, the biggest lobbying group, which has been among the president's harshest critics and funded many Republicans who ran against Democrats in the November election. Well, we don't want that to happen again, so we'll get them on our side. Thomas Ferguson, who I mentioned before, the main specialist on campaign funding, he says it more straight out. He said, what we actually have here is the disappearance from the scene of the best-known and most visible critic of the excesses of the financial sector and his replacement by the sitting CEO of a company that is heavily dependent on government aid of all sorts, including diplomatic assistance to invest more in China, and in fact, straight bailouts. This is not about jobs, he continues, but political money. The White House knows that after the Citizens United case a year ago in the Supreme Court, which essentially gave corporations carte blanche to buy elections, after that case, the White House knows that it's going to need to raise about $1 billion for its reelection campaign. Now, that's the context in which this and other recent appointments need to be judged. I think he's quite right. Take a look at GE. About half of its workforce is abroad. Roughly half of its revenue comes from abroad. It's not a, I mean, it does produce mostly abroad, but it's substantially a financial, gets most, a lot of its revenue from financial operations, for which it did get a hefty bailout. The appointment is heralded as for job growth, but if you think for a minute, it has very little to do with job growth. What it has to do is follow the money. About a century ago, the great political financier, Mark Hanna, said that two things are important in politics. He said, the first is money, and I've forgotten the second one. That's far more true today, vastly more true, especially after the radical changes of the last 30 years and the restriction of electoral democracy to hardly more than a shadow. Well, the State of the Union speech is going to be all about jobs. We know that. Jobs has a special meaning in the English language. It's the way you pronounce the obscene word profits. That's a word you're not allowed to say. So what you call it is jobs. When a politician says, I'm working to increase jobs, you're supposed to understand, I'm working to increase profits. So when you appoint the head of GE to produce jobs and meanwhile help him export jobs and, you know, bail him out of his financial operations, get into trouble and so on, that's improving jobs. That's the standard rhetorical device. There used to be a counterforce, unions, but they're now virtually destroyed in the public sector, and incidentally, that's against the will of the working population. Many polls on this, working people strongly support unionization. In fact, the United States is unique in the industrial world in that there's a huge body of working people. It looks like a third world country as compared with almost any other, certainly any industrial country, but many others. In fact, there have been massive social and engineering problems, state policies, state corporate social engineering programs, to try to maximize use of wasteful use of fossil fuel. It's a very interesting story in itself. Of course, severely harms the environment and the future. And how's that being dealt with? We don't have to have, talk about the wonderful future. We can think what's happening right now. As you know, Obama basically took over the auto industry. Government pretty much owned it. Now, there were a number of things you could do. One thing was to continue the policies that the auto industry had been following. Closing plants, shipping jobs abroad, cutting down salaries and attacking unionization. Well, it's exactly what they did. Meanwhile, while this was going on, while the government was closing auto plants, shipping jobs abroad, the transportation secretary, Roy LaHoud, was in Europe. He was traveling around Spain trying to use federal stimulus money to get contracts to build high-speed rail. Things that could have been done perfectly well in the factories that were being closed here, but with less profit and less money for the financial, for Goldman Sachs and the rest, so therefore not done. Actually, there's more that could have been done. There could have been if the auto industry managers didn't like that, there is an alternative. Once the government essentially owns the industry, could turn that over to the workforce. The workforce and the community, so-called stakeholders, maybe with some help, could run the factories profitably without the need for layers and layers of management and bankers and so on, and do the work here. In fact, there have been efforts to carry that through. They haven't had enough community support or public support to succeed, but they could. Same is true of green technology. Everyone agrees that's the future growth area, but the growth is in places like Spain and Germany and particularly China. U.S. investors do invest in green technology, but in China, because there they get support for it, not here. U.S. as a society is going to fall behind, but concentrated wealth and power will do just fine as long as the population allows it. And without going on, that's the crucial matter throughout, whether it's Egypt or the United States. Will we allow ourselves to be subject to the guiding principle of domestic and international affairs, namely the powerful do what they want as long as they can get away with it, as long as the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders stay quiet and passive. Now, that principle has been contested right through American history. That's why the domains of justice and freedom have expanded quite considerably over time, but not uniformly. There are periods of regression, like right now. It's being contested right now and today, literally today, in places where the conditions are far more onerous than they're here. Egypt, for example, recovering the spirit of democracy and justice, which is a deep current of U.S. history, recovering that is possible, but it's a choice. It won't happen by itself, and a great deal turns on how that choice is made. Thanks.
Unfortunately, we don't have time for question and answer. I'm sorry, but there will be a book. Would you like to do question and answer? It's your call, Mr. or Dr. Chomsky. We actually are going to have a few questions, but we can. we can't go too long though, because
just like
we only
China,
have
where
for
I was recently,
time,
I had to have a translator.
If I may, thank you for being here. It's a pleasure to see you again. A couple of related questions. It seems to me that the way things are moving forward, or is it seems like the ruling class is on a path of self-destruction. What is happening to the liberal class? We're the guardian of situations by sugarcoating things. And a related question: you had stated in the past that regarding global shift in power. Such countries as India and China, that you felt you mentioned that the nations that are divorced from internal power structure are basically won't have much role in the global system. If you could elaborate on that as well.
To the liberal class? Who's the liberal class? It's the Democrats. It's Obama, Obama supporters. They are, like Clinton said, Eisenhower Republicans. For the reasons I mentioned, they're partly out of necessity, you know, what they think is necessity, and partly out of choice. They're pursuing the policies that I've been describing. It's a little different. I mean, there's more complexity than this. So if you look over, I mean, the Democrats have somewhat different constituency than the Republicans. They do have, they used to have at least a working class constituency of poor minorities, women, and so on. And they do, to some extent, respond to their interests. So over the past, there have been some good studies of this. One of the best is by Larry Bartels, good political scientist. And what he points out is that if you take a look over many years, comparing Democratic and Republican administrations, the general population, you know, aside from the very rich, does somewhat better under Democrats. Not a lot. And now the Democrats are increasingly, as I said, becoming moderate Republicans. Obama's the liberal hope. It's his policies are the ones we're seeing.
Yeah, my point was basically, isn't if the current trend continues, doesn't that destabilize a society and this third world model that we're in, or begin, you know, or going toward?
Can you repeat your question,
please? The question I have is given the current economic situation, if this trend continues, creating a disability in the society, the traditional role of neoliberalism was to prevent or to maintain this society. And what happens if this condition continues? Where are the liberals that used to maintain, be a guardian of preventing this?
Traditional role? Well, first of all, remember that the main counterforce to the business-run class war, which goes on all the time, the main counterforce has been the labor movement. That's why the labor movement has been under such bitter attack, actually all through American history, but it keeps reviving. But since the Second World War, when it was quite strong, there has just been a major concerted attack on unions. If you're interested in the scale of it, some good studies. There's a book by Elizabeth Fones Wolfe, not particularly liberal, but she goes through the corporate offensive, propaganda offensive, to try to undermine unions, beginning in the early 50s. I mean, it's just staggering. Cinema, media, you know, takeover of sports league, churches, forced you know, courses and captive audiences and factories, schools, you know, major attack. And it's been successful. In the private sector, unionization is, you know, it's below 10% now. It's also succeeded in creating fear and hatred of unions among a lot of people, not among working people. They want them. But among much of the population, you know, you're supposed to despise unions. It's pretty dramatic this way this works. I mean, I don't know if you guys look at old movies, but back in the early 1950s, 1953, when all this stuff was beginning, there were two major films that came out. One of them was a huge hit. It's called On the Waterfront. The hero is Marlon Brando. And the theme of the movie is that, you know, this ordinary Joe, you know, this honest working man, Marlon Brando, after, you know, finally stands up and overthrows the corrupt union bosses. It ends up with him throwing the union boss into the ocean or something, and you're all supposed to cheer. That's one of them. The other movie was a really great movie, which almost nobody's ever seen. It's called Salt of the Earth. It was a very inexpensively done movie where the theme was feminism and labor. It was about a strike, an important strike, which was actually won with a Hispanic woman more or less leading it, and a lot of worker participation. It's a beautifully done movie. But that had the wrong lesson, so that one tanked. In fact, maybe you can get it in Netflix or something. If you can, it's worth it. But that's what was going on and continues to go on. Now, in the Reagan years, it got much more extreme because the Reagan administration basically pretty much told employers that it's not going to enforce labor laws. And in fact, illegal firing of union organizers tripled, I think, during the Reagan years. Because once you tell the employers, look, we're not going to enforce the rules, fine, let's break up unions illegally. Now, that increased further in the Clinton years, partly this way, but partly by a little device called NAFTA. One of the specific goals of NAFTA, surely, was to undermine U.S. labor unions. NAFTA made it possible for where, say, some organizing effort was going on, for employers to put up big signs saying things like transfer job Mexico, meaning if you try to organize, we're going to shift this to Mexico. And in our system, you could ask why, but the fact of the matter is owners are allowed to make those decisions, not the working people. Maybe, I don't see why, but anyway, that's the way it is, which was a terrific way of breaking strikes. Actually, there was a study done under NAFTA rules by a very good labor economist at Cornell who estimated that the number of breaking of strikes by this method increased by about 50% under Clinton. Now, it's illegal. Of course, corporations are not allowed to do that, but when you have a criminal state, it doesn't matter. You can carry out illegal acts. So there's another attack on unions. Of course, under Bush, got worse. Now there's one residue left, public service unions. They've been protected. That's why they still exist. And what we're seeing right now is a major effort to destroy public service unions. That's why you have this propaganda about how, you know, it's the teachers and the police and the firefighters who are tanking the economy. That's because of these unions, which are giving them such fat pensions and stuff. Again, all total lies, but that doesn't matter. It's repeated in the media, and people tend to believe it. You know, in fact, a lot of polls show that people increasingly believe it, and you can demonize working people this way, just as Obama's doing, and being praised by the liberals. That was the great achievement of the lame duck Congress. And you'll see the reaction, I presume, to the State of the Union, where he announces supposed to announce a five-year freeze. I presume that's going to include a freeze on pay for federal workers, which means a reduction, of course, and it'll undermine unions more.
Thank you.
I think since there are a lot of people, we better try to keep the questions short.
Okay. Thanks for coming. It's great to have you here. What I want to know is, with so much of your life spent towards examining political systems and government policy, have you ever yourself considered running for political office or creating a political party? Because I'd vote for you like that.
Would you ever consider running for political party yourself?
I'd be the worst person you could pick. And in most academic departments like mine at MIT, the graduate department, there are certain jobs which are a pain in the neck, like administratively running the department. So they're circulated among the faculty, usually given to the most junior person, and then everybody has to do it. Over the last 50 years, I'm the one person who's never been selected because they know I'll make such a mess of it that they'll want to. No, I couldn't do it. You know. Furthermore, it's totally impossible. The only person who can win an election is somebody who can, in our current system, is somebody who can amass hundreds of millions of dollars from the major core components of the economy, like the financial institutions. So it's just not even an option, the way things stand now.
I'm sorry, this will be the last question, though. We don't have time for any more.
Okay.
Oh, so this is the last question? Okay. Sorry.
Can you hear me?
One woman in there, so why don't you ask the question? Two questions. Two questions.
Yeah.
Oh, you're starting the line. Okay.
Guarding the line.
Oh, guarding the line. Okay, go ahead.
Can you hear me, Noam?
I can't, but she can.
Obviously. I have a short quote from Bacon on seditions and troubles. I'd like to read.
Quote from who?
It says, "It is a certain sign of a wise government and proceeding when it can hold men's hearts by hopes, when it cannot by satisfaction, when it can handle things in such manner as no evil shall appear so peremptory, but that it had some outlet of hope."
Why don't you give it to me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, this is Bacon, not Bagan, which I thought it was at first. It is a certain sign of a wise government and proceeding when it can hold men's hearts by hopes, when it cannot by satisfaction, and when it can handle things in such manner as no evil shall appear so peremptory, but that it hath some outlet of hope, which is the less hard to do, because both particular persons and factions are apt enough to flatter themselves, or at least to brave that which they believe not. They used to have nice long sentences in the 17th century. I think the thrust of it is that if you offer hope, rather than, and don't worry about satisfaction, you may make it. You'll be a wise government. It sounds like a prescription for the Obama campaign. I mean, I don't usually agree with Sarah Palin, you know, but when Sarah Palin makes jokes about what happened to that Hopi Changey stuff, it's hard to disagree. If you take a look back at the, you look back at the rhetoric of the campaign, it was hope and change. Actually, if you look back, that was the same for McCain. He also talked about hope and change, but he didn't do it as effectively, and financial institutions didn't like him as much, and, you know, and so on. But hope and change for what? You know, what was it? What's it supposed to be? Well, we could see what it is right away. First act of the administration was to pick an economic team. Of course, we're in the midst of a big financial crisis. Financial crisis had been created by deregulation, by criminal activities of the big banks, by fraud, and so on and so forth. So who's your economic team? The people who perpetrated it. So, for example, Robert Rubin, who was the kind of guru and the one Obama listened to, he was Treasury Secretary under Clinton. His great one of his great achievements was to push through the retraction of the Glass-Steagall Act, the Depression-era Act, which separated commercial banks from investment firms so that commercial banks would be pretty safe. Investment firms can make wild actions, but it's not going to harm the savings of people. So Rubin helped break that down, along with Phil Gramm, Republican senator. The first thing he did after he broke that down was leave the Treasury Department, become a director of Citigroup, which immediately benefited from that act by picking up a major insurance company, leading the way to its tanking, at which point the public bailed him out and he walked away with tens of millions of dollars. So that's the guy you pick to be the head. The next advisor is Larry Summers, who fought really hard to break down regulation of derivatives, exotic financial instruments. They're another major contribution to the crisis, and so on down the line. In fact, the Bloomberg News, which is one of the major business journals, had an article right after Obama picked his economic team, and they ran through each one of them and their background and said, conclusion was, these guys shouldn't be making economic decisions, they should be in court facing subpoenas. I mean, they're the ones who created the disaster. Right? And from then on, it goes on from there. I mean, take the health reform, big exciting thing. First of all, the health reform was welcomed by the insurance companies. You go back and read the business press in August 2009, Business Week had a front page story. Insurance companies, hailing health reform. Then after that, they continued to fight against it because it wasn't good enough for them. But what they liked was they were getting a lot of new customers paid for by the government, but the running the program was going to be in their hands. They'll make the money from it. I mean, some regulations they didn't like, and now they're trying to get rid of the regulations. But not very good for them. The public, for decades, you look at polls, either a considerable majority or a big plurality, depends how the question's asked, have been in favor of a national health system, like every other industrial country, which would be much more efficient, much lower administrative costs, much more effective. But that's been considered politically impossible. In fact, that's the word that's used. Well, Obama was talking about it before he got into office, but that quickly disappeared. There was a little residue of it, the public option, but the financial system didn't like that. The public did. By about 2-1, the public favored the public option. That was given away without even an effort, kind of like the tax cut for the rich. 2-1 opposed, but who cares about them? One of the crazy things in the American healthcare system, different from any other country, is that by law, the government is not permitted to negotiate drug prices. So, of course, they go out of sight. Drug prices are much higher than other countries. There's one exception. The Veterans Administration, the government is allowed to negotiate, so, of course, they're much lower. The public's opposed to that by about 85%. Obama gave it away without even a word, And so it goes down the line. And yes, if you can give people hope, you don't have to give them satisfaction, except it breaks down pretty fast. It broke down by the last election. Here we see it breaking down in Egypt. There they didn't even try to give them hope, just force.
Let's all thank Professor Chomsky for coming one more time.